Watford Manager Bingo. Hello and welcome to episode 10 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's one up top. But what a one it is. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Max. So Max, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, completely fine. I went on holiday to Brighton with my girlfriend. That was very nice. So I actually missed the Palace game, which I thought was a very good thing when we were 2-0 down. But then, you know, it would have been nice to see the comeback at Selhurst Park. But yeah, really looking forward to starting this week.
Good man. I used to live in Brighton, so you've got my respect there. But what's it like going on holiday to what I guess is your biggest rivals?
Yeah, I know. I was thinking about wearing a Palace top just to be, you know, antagonistic and defiant and all that kind of thing. But I stuck to my Palace face mask and managed to avoid getting beaten up by any of the Brighton firms. So good times.
A sage move. Obviously, you wouldn't be here today. But, of course, big shouts to Kyle and Matthew, who are doing some scouting work for me. So me and Max are going to take the full load this week. Before we do, let's do the social media bits. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, @DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is @RealFootballPod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to leave a review so we move up the league table. Subscribe so we don't miss a single episode. And also, just get involved with the show on Twitter. And also, I need to mention my content partner, that being betting.com. So for tips, predictions, any day of the week, if you want a bet, a wager, a punt, if you will, go to that website. Also, the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E. You get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. Where should we go first? Let's go to Vicarage Road because it's time to play Watford Manager Bingo. And Max, did you happen to have Sunday, October 3rd on this season's scorecard?
No, I didn't actually. No, I didn't. I'm pretty baffled by the whole thing because, you know, you understand that Watford, the owners are a little bit trigger happy and they've got a long, long, long history of doing that. But normally it's when Watford are in the relegation zone and you can kind of understand them wanting to, you know, twist rather than stick. But Watford are in a pretty good position. You know, they're 15th. They're 4 points clear of the relegation zone. They're above, you know, established Premier League sides like Burnley and Southampton. They're outperforming Leeds. They're level with Palace. And I'm pretty positive about Palace this season, to be honest. And they're only just behind, you know, Leicester, who are 1 point behind Leicester, who are challenging for Champions League football last season. I heard that the performance against Leeds and the defeat against Leeds was the kind of catalyst for sacking him. But I thought they've had considering their promoted side, I think they've had a pretty good start to the Premier League, and they look, you know, quite lively in attack and decent in defence. Obviously, you know, they're not going to go any great guns and start moving up the table and qualifying for Europe or anything like that. But I thought they've started really, really well, relatively in their battle against relegation. But, you know, if there is one club that is going to sack their manager when they're doing all right, it's Watford. And it's just, you know, another manager to go on the merry-go-round there.
Well, as you say, if it was 1 point from 21, a la Norwich, you'd be almost sort of thinking to yourself, I can understand why. When you see Watford sack their managers at this time of the season, you think to yourself, it's a bit of a surprise, but because of their MO and how they operate, it's not a surprise. So with them being such a transient club in terms of managers and players, is that what stops them from kicking on to the next level? Because they're happy to make up the numbers, and their kind of process is, well, if we keep just being ruthless and getting a new manager in, that'll keep our heads above water. It works most of the time. It failed a couple of seasons ago. But should they not be putting down foundations and roots to actually try and then build on this and try and get up to mid-table and not just be floating around the kind of 12th to 17th bracket each and every season? So I know it's easy for us as a pundit, analyst, whatever, to sort of say, well, you should be doing this, but why aren't they doing that?
Yeah, it's a good question, you know. It's a good question. And I guess they would say that previously, when they've been doing that, you know, from their perspective, the majority of the time it's worked, as in, you know, they've stayed in the Premier League. That I think they had quite a reasonable stay in the Premier League before they went down 2 years ago. And so, you know, I guess they would say that it's been successful for them, in the same way that Abramovich at Chelsea might say, yeah, well, you know, I've been pretty ruthless with my managers, and, you know, if they're not doing well, I'll have no qualms about sacking them. You know, Mourinho twice, and Villas-Boas, Scolari, you know, Hiddink, all of these people who came in, Di Matteo as well, from Grant, and yet Chelsea are still winning trophies. And so from the silverware perspective, Abramovich will think, well, I'm still getting trophies by adopting this policy, therefore it must be all right. And I guess Watford might have thought, well, you know, if we're still staying in the division the majority of the time that we do it, then I guess it's worth us doing it. And, you know, I think it's just that they think the grass is always greener. And look, I understand Ranieri is, you know, well known to the owners. He's obviously done well in Italy. He won the title with Leicester, as everyone knows. But is he going to do a significantly better job than Zisco at Watford? I'm not sure. I mean, the last time he was in the league, he contributed to Fulham going down, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think they changed their manager towards the end of the season, but he was still there for a large part of that season and kind of left it in. I think it was Parker who replaced him, wasn't it?
That's,
yeah,
right.
So he still left Parker with an almost impossible job to do there. And so, you know, I just don't think he's going to be significantly better. And the flip side to that argument that it tends to work for them is that you don't know how the managers would have done if you'd given them time. They might have outperformed the managers that you replaced them with. And, you know, it'd be really interesting to kind of view a parallel universe and see where Watford would have finished in the league under Zisco, because I reckon they might well have finished outside the relegation zone. And, you know, Ranieri could well keep them up this season, but that's not to say that Zisco wouldn't have. And, yeah, it just seems like a kind of an overhaul for the sake of it and change for the sake of it. And, you know, I understand you need to move forward if you feel like it's not working out, but the results and the performances on the pitch seem decent, which is why it's a little bit surprising to me. But then, as you say, it's Watford, so you can never be surprised.
Well, we've got no parallel universe. We can only sort of deal with the one we're in. So Claudio Ranieri has taken charge, as we've mentioned. Will he last the season? Let's say Watford are hovering over the relegation zone with four games to spare. It could go either way. If you know Watford, they'll pull the trigger and try and roll the dice very late on, won't they? So it's not a given that Ranieri will be in the job till May. And even if he's in the job till May, they might go, well, thanks for everything, and start again. So it's so short-term, isn't it? I know he's old and we shouldn't be ageist either, but what is the point of his appointment, really?
Yeah, it does seem like that he's just going to be waiting to be sacked. I mean, yeah, Obviously there's a lot in it for him, because he knows that he's kind of got a free pass, and if they go down, he'll get sacked and probably get a nice payoff from getting sacked. And if he keeps them up, he'll get a nice, you know, relegation avoidance clause bonus, I'm sure. And it'll be on a decent wage as well. He's probably been told he can spend money in January. So there's not much to lose from his perspective. But for Watford, it just seems strange, because, you know, he could carry on a long time. And we've seen, you know, Warnock and Hodgson and Mick McCarthy and people carrying on like that, you know, into and around and past 70, and their 70s. But it doesn't seem like a long-term appointment. Even if he keeps them up, as you say, what's to stop Watford saying, right, you know, you've done your job now, let's get a younger manager in with fresh ideas, which is kind of what they did when they brought in Zisco.
Zisco, exactly.
So I just don't understand. It's like a never-ending cycle of new managers. They're going to run out of managers. You know, Watford are just going to be going through them all. There's going to be no one left. It's a little bit bizarre to me. And you know what I thought was really weird in the season they went down is they brought Nigel Pearson in, you know, really tough and uncompromising and, you know, very masculine manager in terms of, you know, if you want to equate masculinity with like calling journalists ostrich and strangling players on the sidelines and things like that. But and they got him in and, you know, they toughened up a little bit and they were, you know, really fighting for results in games, and the results picked up a little bit and they looked like they might stay up. And then they sacked him with like four games left and gave it to a caretaker manager, Hayden Mullins.
Sorry.
Literally had no experience in management at all compared to Pearson's like 30 years in management. And obviously they went down. And I was thinking, did you really need to do that with like three games left? I understand if, you know, if you're like in the relegation zone and there's like at least a couple of months left for the new man to kind of get a new manager bounce. But it's, it just seems a bit strange. I think like they're addicted to the to that prospect of the new manager bounce and what that might get them. But it seems very strange to me.
Yeah, I wonder how much the bounce is worth. It's probably worth a bit of research. I mean, I could probably do it. But in terms of the bounce, if you were to say every six games a new manager takes, what does that get Watford in points? I guess it'd be interesting to see what happens. But in terms of Watford as a whole, do you actually take an interest in them? I think Matthew hit the nail on the head a couple of weeks back that it's hard to really care about a club which is so transient and such a mockery, such a sort of derisible figure in the world of football. Do you know what I mean? It's like, what do they offer to the Premier League bar a great talking point every few months?
Yeah, it is difficult to kind of get invested in a club because you don't really know what they stand for apart from standing for nothing. Like, you know, there's no principles. That really, there's no kind of guiding ethos seemingly at the club, and you know, there's not really a way that they want to do things. Whereas, you know, at least with Southampton, you know, for example, that they like to play quite nice football, 4-4-2, a lot of youth players, you know, counter-attacking, nice possession, buy young players, sell them on for a profit, that kind of thing. You know, Leeds have a very distinct kind of setup. Burnley and Newcastle similarly. Even though, you know, you can argue about the relative degrees of success that they've had, but, and you know, even Norwich, you can say, well, they've got a way of doing things as a club, and those are the five teams below them, the only five teams below them in the Premier League, and all of those teams have a kind of a defined, distinct way of doing things as a club, as playing football, of signing players, of hiring managers, and Watford just seem to be kind of adrift of all of that. They just seem to be kind of floating along and hoping that they'll stay up, and you know, they have got a decent team and they could stay up, but yeah, I'd fear for them, for example, if Saar left in January, who's obviously their key player, and they have got some good players, but it's just difficult to know what they are, and I wonder how fans feel about this.
Where they sit,
because you know, even like with Palace, so under Hodgson they had a way of playing, and it was a little bit kind of dour and defensive, but you knew that they would likely stay in the Premier League, and that was just Palace's way of trying to ensure the financial stability that the Premier League brings. Now they're doing things a different way, but at least you know that the way they're doing it, whereas with Watford, it just seems they're kind of plodding along, trying to avoid relegation. I guess that they might think that, you know, constantly refreshing the manager is their way of doing that, but I can't see it being a long-term success, to be honest.
No, and as you say, from a fan's perspective, can you even get attached or excited about players? Saar being a perfect example, that in a sense, everyone's in the shop window, either from external bids or their own kind of network of clubs, that they'll just kind of get moved around. So you might think, oh, he's a decent hand. And by January, a nice offer comes in, you're kind of back to just shipping another sort of player in. The kind of pieces are all interchangeable, but you can't really have much desire or admiration for these players because you know really within 12, 18 months, they're just going to be gone and it all starts again. So it's almost like that Greek mythology where the bloke has to push the big boulder up the hill and he gets to the top and it rolls back down again and they just never really push forward. Let's move on, because let's talk about some actual football now, because there were some good clashes to take place over the weekend. A heavyweight title clash once more at Anfield, Max, and one that saw honours even between Liverpool and Man City. For you, though, was a share of the points the right result?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a fair result, and what a game it was.
Yeah.
You know, real end to end, and the kind of momentum swinging between the two teams. Obviously, you know, Liverpool scoring, then City equalising. Liverpool scored again. City scoring late, and it was a real title tussle. And I tell you what, City have had the week from hell in terms of the kind of fixture list. I think they're away at Chelsea, and then PSG, and then Liverpool, which is about as hard as it gets in club football, and you know, they've come away with three very good performances, kind of mixed results. They obviously beat Chelsea, lost to PSG, drew with Liverpool, but the performances in all of those games were really, really strong, And I think that bodes very well for Pep Guardiola and his side, because results can, you can get undeserved results. You can play really well against PSG and lose. It happens in football. But if you're turning out quality performances like that regularly, consistently, when you're up against the caliber of opposition that they faced in this last week or so, I think that's a real cause for optimism for City.
Well, I was going to say, my next question, that Man City, Liverpool, Chelsea have already played each other in this first portion of the season, which is quite strange the way the fixture computer has sort of divvied it out early. But from those first wave of clashes, City have got 4 points, and 4 points on the road. So although the league table suggests different at the moment, do City have the strongest hand because of the points they've accrued against their two nearest rivals?
Yeah, I very much think so. And, we've seen this season, home advantage is much more of a factor with fans being back in the ground. Palace, for example, are unbeaten at home, and we look so much a better side with the fans in. I think obviously Sheffield United really struggled with that last season. Leeds, you could say too. Everton had really bad home results last season, and for a lot of clubs, the home support is going to be really pivotal. And in a game between two title rivals where the margins are so fine, that the home advantage is such a big thing. And so with City yet to play those sides at home, I think they will fancy themselves to at least win, get a draw from the game, if not win the game against Chelsea and Liverpool. And I think Chelsea, Liverpool, City will be the top three. And City can say, well, we played both of them away from home in the league. We're 1 point behind Liverpool, 2 points behind Chelsea. We're in an absolutely great position. City are... Yeah, they're such a strong team, and given that they've got these games with the home advantage against Chelsea and Liverpool yet to come, I think they should feel pretty confident. And as you say, they're still lying in third, and they're level on points with Brighton, which no one would have expected after seven games. But I think they're really kind of poised in a strong position in the title race.
In terms of the game itself, I think if we go by the boxing analogy of a heavyweight title clash, the first half was sparring, light sparring really, before the kind of main event, the knockout blows in the second half. So where did it go wrong in the first 45 for Liverpool? They didn't quite have the out ball, the counter-attack that we usually see from them. There was obviously a rocket fired up their arse during the interval, because Jurgen Klopp must have had a word, because they were a different side, but they didn't quite get out of the blocks, did they?
Yeah, and I wonder how much of a different Trent is making in that. Not only for his kind of overlapping runs and stretching the pitch and using the width and things like that and overlapping beyond Salah, but also with his kind of missile range passing, because so often we've seen it that Trent just has the ball in a very unthreatening position, maybe even sometimes inside his own half, and he'll just ping like a 65-yard crossfield ball onto the boot of Robertson, and it just gets Liverpool going. And so I think he's a really, really big miss for them. And Milner, very, very dependable, consistent player, but he just doesn't offer the same kind of dynamic play and athleticism that Trent does. And that's understandable at his age, without meaning to sound patronising, because he's still very, capable of contributing for Liverpool. But I think maybe... the lack of Trent didn't quite help them in that respect. And City are very good at taking the sting out of attacks of opposition teams, even at a place like Anfield. Obviously, they came back into the second half. And yeah, Klopp will be wanting to introduce that kind of energy and that kind of urgency from the first half. But it is difficult when you're playing against City.
And you mentioned James Milner. Obviously, bar the top quality goals, which we'll discuss in a moment, that was the main talking point on how he stayed on the pitch. Now, it was a battle between him and Phil Foden in the first half, pace versus a model pro, and in that aspect, pace is always going to win. But second half, how is he still on the pitch? Because you've got that sort of combination foul between him and Henderson. Was it the fact the referee may have thought it was Henderson that committed that foul, not Milner, which keeps Milner on the pitch?
Possibly. I think, there were arguably three yellow card fouls from Milner. And so I think the one that he was really, really lucky to get away with was the Bernardo one.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
when Bernardo gets through past him, and he literally swings his back leg out to try and obviously stop him, you know, bring him down cynically. He's obviously not going for the ball, ending an attack. It's an absolute blatant yellow card. And you know what? It kind of peed me off when, and I know I can say pissed off, but I don't know. I always feel like I shouldn't swear on this kind of thing. But it peed me off when Palace played Liverpool, because Milner should have had, he should have had probably two or maybe even three yellow cards in that match. He was up against Zaha, and I was kind of relishing the prospect of Zaha going up against the you know veteran kind of midfielder playing out of position like Milner, and he was fouling all over the place and didn't. I don't think he got booked once. He might have got booked towards the very end of the game, and it really annoyed me seeing comments from Liverpool fans saying like, "Oh, Milner pocketed Zaha and things like that," when he's fouled him about seven times and he should have been off the pitch. And yeah, Liverpool at Anfield is just that Liverpool at Anfield and United at Old Trafford are probably the two places where refereeing decisions are swayed and influenced the absolute most. And, you know, because basically Klopp and Solskjaer are both known to criticise referees heavily if they don't get what they want. And they're not alone in that in the Premier League. It's not only them, but referees know they're going to get an earful if they don't give decisions, you know, the right way according to who the home side is. And so, yeah, if I was Guardiola, I would have been absolutely fuming, because Milner definitely should have got two yellow cards, and possibly, you know, there were, like I say, there were even maybe three incidents where he could have got booked. And so, yeah, Liverpool were lucky to still have 11 on the pitch. But, you know, it's not unheard of at Anfield, as the guys hopefully mentioned the other week. I don't think I was there the week that Liverpool beat Palace at Anfield, but we should have had a Stonewall penalty.
Yeah.
Tsimikas doing a very similar thing to what Milner did to Bernardo. Tsimikas did that to Benteke inside the box, and it seemingly wasn't even looked at VAR. So I would be very frustrated if I were Guardiola. But you know, at the same time, City get those kind of decisions at the Etihad as well. So it's not like they're just a kind of a smaller club and they're always on the wrong end of these decisions. You know, they probably do get their fair share, but in this instance Guardiola was right to be aggrieved.
Yeah, because as you say, it's not just one foul that's gone missing in terms of a yellow card which should have seen Milner get his marching orders. The referee's got it wrong twice, and when you're a manager in that kind of high profile, potentially title deciding spectacle, you want the big decisions to be correct, don't you? So to have one overlooked is annoying. Two, you can see Pep Guardiola's visible frustration, and rightly so, to be honest. But I guess more frustration would have come with Mo Salah's goal. So it depends what kind of goal you like as your favourites, but it's easily one of the goals of the season so far. But is he, at the moment, one of the best players in the world? Because we're kind of in a post-Messi-Ronaldo era. That kind of duopoly is gone, and there's no real king to the throne just yet. Is Mo Salah that man?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I would call him one of the best players in the world. I'd say he's world class. I don't know if he's potentially ready to be heir apparent to Messi or Ronaldo. But I mean, the kind of goals he's delivering, I think, was it 2 years ago he scored like 38 goals or something, or 35 goals, 37, something like that, in the Premier League. He is posting kind of ridiculous numbers, and he does miss a fair amount of chances, but then, you know, so does Ronaldo, and his numbers are just unbelievable. And every now and then he pulls out a kind of a world class moment like that goal against City, and it makes you kind of remember that he is that good a player. Because when Salah scores kind of week to week in the Premier League, I think people kind of almost there's an oversaturation of his talent and his goals, because it's almost every week he's scoring. You know, and he's such a kind of an elite finisher and poacher that people are like, oh yeah, Salah scored again, and you don't almost register it even. But when he scores a goal like that, and I'm trying to think of other goals that he scored. I think he might have scored another one
against Spurs,
similar to that.
Against
Spurs.
Yeah,
against
Spurs. Exactly.
Yeah, you know the one I mean. And then the one against Chelsea where he got the ball like right on the right touchline and kind of ran in about 15 yards and put it in the top corner. There was one against Arsenal as well, where he turned Luiz. He's just he is just absolutely class. And, you know, I'm saying I'm not sure he's ready to be, you know, the next Messi or Ronaldo or the next best player in the world. But I'm struggling to think of any, you know, right-sided attackers, players in his position who are as good. You know, maybe Mbappe, but arguably Mbappe's been a little bit off form this season. And in terms of potential, Mbappe, you'd say, is probably going to be the next Messi or Ronaldo, or, you know, clearly the next best player in the world. But for his position, I think Salah probably is the best in the world at the moment. And yeah, what a goal it was. City will probably feel like they could have done better. They had so many players around him. You know, Guardiola, probably what he would have wanted them to do if he had his time again was to just do a little foul on him outside the box and just to kind of get him down before all of that happens. Because I think he had Foden and Cancelo and one other player around him, and he managed to wriggle away from all of them. And, you know, they'll feel like the play that happened later, obviously it was a fantastic play to kind of turn past Laporte and finish, but they'll feel like maybe it shouldn't have got to that stage. But, I mean, what an individual goal, and, yeah, what a player.
Yeah, I think Cancelo was on a yellow at that point, so it would have been a bit reckless for him to go to ground, and then you've got double jeopardy of perhaps a penalty if it goes wrong and a red card. So I can see why he didn't go to ground. Foden should have really been a bit stronger, created more of a barrier, but we can't lambast him too much because he did get the first equaliser. So is he living up to a tag of big game player? I know he's been managed in terms of minutes over the past few seasons. That's obviously paid off. He hasn't had too much too soon, but he's becoming quickly one of the City players that you can count upon when it really matters.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll probably remember the City game against Liverpool last season, where he completely ran the show. He absolutely terrorised Liverpool in that game. And yeah, what we're seeing is Foden will kind of drift in and out of Premier League games sometimes in terms of minutes. As in, you know, sometimes he'll play kind of midfield, sometimes he'll play on either wing, sometimes false nine. And he's often used as like a player off the bench to kind of make a difference. But Guardiola knows that in his strongest 11, in the big games, Foden is in there. And like you say, his minutes have been managed really, really well by Guardiola, because we've seen what's happened with like Wilshere at Arsenal, for example. And like Pedri at Barcelona. Pedri's going to get a serious injury soon, I imagine, because he's just being overplayed. He played like 60 games for Barcelona last season, 50, 60 games, and then played for Spain at the Euros, and then played for Spain at the Olympics. It's just stupid. And then he's back into another massive season. I understand that managers want to use their best players, but when they're young, you've got a duty of care. Like, you've got a responsibility to protect these players. And Guardiola has done that very well, because he knows that Foden has got a very slight build. You know, he's going to get a lot of kicks and he's going to be targeted by players. Grealish, he's been playing regular in the Premier League for Villa. And so he's, you know, maybe got a bit more durability. But Foden is, he's like 5'7", you know, not a single scrap of fat on him. And injuries, you feel like, are going to come if you play him regularly. And so Guardiola's managed that really nicely. But yeah, as you say, when the big games come around, Foden is in the team. And it's not Raheem Sterling anymore. You know, Sterling was always his go-to guy in those games. And I think we're maybe seeing a changing of the guard now, because last season it was, you know, Mahrez off the right, Sterling off the left, both of them cutting in onto their stronger foot. And, you know, even like Gundogan was in centre mid and Bernardo Silva wasn't getting a look in. Now it's Jesus on the right and Foden on the left, and Bernardo's playing much more in central midfield. He was, again, fantastic against Liverpool. And so, yeah, Guardiola is, he's very willing to change his team depending on who's in form and that kind of thing. But I think it says a lot that when the big games come around, Foden's in there.
What did you make of Jack Grealish? I mean, you could extend this question to the season so far. Do we have to almost forget the £100 million price tag, because he might never live up to that because it was just too expensive in the first place? So you're kind of sort of thinking, is it just a case of what he does on the pitch rather than performing to a certain value? Because, you know, when Fernando Torres went to Chelsea, he was always the £50 million Fernando Torres and never lived up to that. So do we have to try and detach the price and just sort of see what Grealish does for City?
Yeah, it's difficult because it's kind of inevitable that when you move for that kind of money, people are going to make reference to it. And it does feel like, you know, the kind of prefix of 100 million is is like becoming more and more obligatory with Grealish. People are saying like, oh, £100 million midfielder, Jack Grealish, just like people would say like Frank Lampard's Derby.
Yeah.
And you just couldn't say Derby without Frank Lampard being there in front of it. Or like Danny Ings, a commentator never says Ings, do they?
That's absolutely right. He's a part of full name yeah, club. I've noticed like, that.
It's becoming like more and more tied to his name, and I feel like that it's kind of unreasonable pressure, really, because yeah, like you say, you know, that kind of weight of pressure and expectation, it can weigh really heavily on a player. And you know, we've seen lots of world class players come to the Premier League. You know, Shevchenko and Torres was already in the league, kind of moving to another club, but when you move for that kind of money, it's really difficult to justify that, because you know, how many goals or assists would he need to get? How many players would he need to go past to justify the price tag? You can never justify it, really, because it's just silly money.
Yeah.
You know, there's no like set number after which you can, you know, you can be okay, 237 players. Now that 100 million is justified. Like, there's no money. There's no like particular marker you can pass. And so I think we kind of just have to take the pressure off a little bit and just say, well, you know, is he performing to a high standard? Yes. Is he helping City in big games? Yes. And, you know, that's what they paid the money for. They probably knew that 100 million is maybe a little bit overpriced for, you know, for almost any player in the world, that money is overpriced or it's a very, very high figure. And so it's always difficult to live up to that. But, you know, they knew that they wanted to buy him, and that was the money that Villa were demanding, and that's what they had to pay, and so that's what they paid. He has been good. He's been getting a lot of minutes as well. He hasn't been rotated much, so I think Guardiola is really keen to bed him in and get him used to their style and you know, get him involved a lot. You can see lots of players giving him the ball, and so yeah, that is a positive for him. He will have probably wanted to have a couple more goal involvements at this point in the season, but you know, it's very early days, and I'm sure he's going to be a really good player for them.
Yeah, I think it's certainly been a pass so far. Like I say, if you just detach the value of the transfer and see what he's done, I don't think you could have too much criticism of him already. As you say, maybe the odd assist or an extra goal here and there, but I think it's been fine for Grealish. So we mentioned the goal for Salah. That would have been great news for FPL captains around the world, although a whole host would have bemoaned the fact across Manchester that Ronaldo was benched for Man United on Saturday. Did it prove a costly decision for you, Max, or was it more a costly decision for Ollie?
Yes, so I actually captained Mikel Antonio, and so that did go very well for me. With Ronaldo, I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty of my FPL team in case anyone listening doesn't play. But yeah, basically with people like Antonio and Salah, you feel like the vast majority of the time they're going to play 85 minutes plus. You know, their minutes are pretty much guaranteed. They might miss the odd game if they're injured, or you know, maybe rotated and rested in a very kind of busy, turbulent period. But with Ronaldo, you feel like there's always that risk of him being kind of rotated and dropped to the bench and that kind of thing. He, at his age as well, because he's obviously in very good shape for his age. And you know, people say like, oh, in his medical at United, doctors said he had like the body of a 25-year-old or the physique of a 25-year-old or something. But he is, you know, you do want to protect him from injury. And Ole knows that Ronaldo is going to want to play Ronaldo in all the biggest games in the Champions League and things like that. And with the Champions League going on, and you know, the League Cup fixtures happening at the moment as well, you know, United are often playing like three games a week, and if you want Ronaldo to be in the team for the biggest ones, he is going to miss his fair share of games. And so basically I'm a little bit hesitant to have him in my team, because if I did have him in my team, I'd be a little bit hesitant to captain him, because you just never know exactly when he's going to play. Whereas, you know, captaining Salah or Antonio, in theory, it's easier for you to know that they're going to play basically 95% of the time, whereas with Ronaldo there's always that little risk that he might not.
If only I heard this advice before Saturday, because I made the exact mistake of captaining Ronaldo. But my logic was that he is 36, and as we kind of said before, he's got the body of a 25-year-old. So my theory was, well, play him all the time, because he isn't really 36 in body, only in number. But obviously Ollie has known different, seen different, and he knows much more than you or I. So with that in mind, is the fact that Ronaldo is going to be playing more of a fleeting role, well, not a fleeting role, but as you kind of expertly explained, not guaranteed to play all the time. Does that make the difference between Man United genuinely challenging the top three and probably being just comfortably fourth?
You know, I don't think so. I think even if Ronaldo managed to stay injury-free for the whole season and played and was able to play 90 minutes in every single game that they played until the rest of the season, it won't happen, but like theoretically, if he were able to do that, I still think United would finish fourth. Because, you know, I might have backed them for the title a couple of weeks ago and say I'm maybe a little bit short-term with my thinking, but...
we've all been there.
Yeah, but I just feel like United have kind of... They've got problems at in centre mid. Their depth at the back isn't great. I just think Chelsea and Liverpool and Man City are going to be stronger teams in challenging for the Premier League title. And, you know, thinking about it, even if Ronaldo's out, obviously he's a great, great player. But actually up front, they've got quite a lot of options. And so when Ronaldo doesn't play, you saw they brought in Cavani. Cavani's a good player, very experienced player, you know, really good finisher. Sancho is, you know, kind of yet to hit the ground running, but he's an option in one of those three spots behind the striker. Rashford is coming back from injury. Martial is back in the team and scored his first goal of the season now as well. So I don't think that there's, you know, a huge drop-off in terms of if Ronaldo's out, you know, are United going to be completely toothless in attack? I don't think so. I think they've got enough depth in their attacking ranks that they won't miss Ronaldo too much if he doesn't play or if he's rested. I think, you know, as I say, their problems are kind of at fullback, and if, you know, sure, Wan-Bissaka are injured, Telles and Dalot, I'm not really sure, are Premier League title-winning fullbacks. If Varane or Maguire's out, I think there's a bit of a drop-off. You know, centre mid, as I say, again, they're pretty weak. Even their starting team is pretty weak in centre mid. And so, I don't think United are going to be properly challenging with or without Ronaldo.
I guess the other difference will be dropping points at home. And Everton did well to earn one. They could have had three. I know they had the ball in the net, but it was chalked off for offside. So really, Max, does Tom Davies need a bit more confidence in that late situation? Should he be asking a difficult question of David De Gea?
It's difficult. It's difficult because, you know, arguably if that were Gray or Townsend or Calvert-Lewin or Richarlison or whoever, you know, they probably shoot in that situation. And, you know, when you shoot, you've got a chance of scoring. But De Gea was on pretty good form in that game. He's been on pretty good form this season. The angle was a little bit tight. So, you know, you're not guaranteed to score if you do shoot. He's also a centre midfielder in Davis, one who hasn't actually played loads recently. When he does play, he tends to be kind of one of the deeper central midfield players rather than like attacking midfield. So, you know, he might be a little bit rusty. I can't imagine the last time he scored for Everton. It could well have been a year or two ago. And actually, a lot in these situations, a lot of times, you see players kind of go through and they have a presentable opportunity or a chance to shoot. And there's a player in a fantastic position to shoot, and they don't square it. And you think, oh, if only they had a bit more awareness, or, you know, if they had their head up a little bit rather than white line fever, so to speak, then, you know, they would have squared it to the player in a much better position and it would have been a goal. I actually think, you know, I don't mind Davis's decision at all. I think possibly it was even the right decision, but it was just kind of slightly the wrong execution in terms of timing from Davis and also in terms of Mina timing his run.
Yeah, I think
so. I think if that's a forward player,
yeah,
I think they might hold back just that little step and then run onto it. Because Mina didn't need to be in an offside position. He could have started onside and easily easily got his legs there. He's like 6'5", 6'6". He could have stretched out. He could have even ran onto it and just tapped it in. So I actually think it was the right decision from Davis, given the situation. But maybe he held onto the ball for just a second too long and Mina was just a kind of half step ahead of where he should have been. But yeah, I actually think it could have been the right decision.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in the sense that Mina's anticipation was probably the thing that got it just wrong. Well, obviously it was wrong because the goal didn't stand. But you're right in the sense that if it's a Calvert-Lewin or Richarlison, their anticipation is much better. They hold their run, they time it right. Everton probably sneak a winner there. But in terms of the leveller, which did stand, Andros Townsend's celebration was the talking point of the day. Was there any disrespect in that? Because I know after the game he said it was to show respect, but do you think there's an element of him covering his tracks with his comments?
Maybe. I mean, it's kind of difficult to tell, really, because, yeah, I don't know. Like, Benteke, so Benteke's celebration is the silencer. You've probably seen it where he, like, taps his chest twice and, like, pushes his knee up in the air and pushes his hands down. And that's, like, a tribute to LeBron James, who does that when he, like, when he scores in a basketball match. And so when Benteke does that, he's not necessarily doing it to be disrespectful to the opposition that he's playing. It's kind of his own personal thing. But I think when you're... was it at Old Trafford, the match?
Yep.
Yeah, when you're at Old Trafford and Ronaldo's on the pitch and you score an equaliser and do the celebration that he specifically has been doing, but just against them, I think, you know, there's an element of being a little bit antagonistic. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, by the way. I don't think he has to explain himself or cover his comments. You know, Vardy, for example, famously, like, tailors his celebration to the team that he's playing. So, like, when he scored against Wolves, he, like, howled at the sky. And when he played against Palace, he did that, like, little eagle celebration and stuff. I think that's great. I think there's nothing wrong with that at all. I think, you know, it makes the game more interesting rather than, you know, what I find super boring is, look, I understand that players don't want to disrespect their former clubs and stuff, but, like, when players score against a former club and they just refuse to celebrate, I just find it a bit silly. Like, you know, how many goals do you score in your Premier League career? Probably, you know, about, like, 50 if you're a good Premier League player. You don't get the opportunity that much. So if I scored, I'd be going absolutely crazy. Absolutely. No matter who it was against.
Yeah.
So
I fully agree with that, because it grinds my gears. It's like, just give it. Do you know what I mean? Oh, mark of respect. I can't be showing my, like, jubilation as I've just scored. Like, just, life's too short. Just go and, you know, flick the V's, do whatever. Just go and celebrate.
Yeah, live your best life.
Exactly.
So I don't mind it at all. I don't think it was, I mean, maybe, obviously I can't speak for his own personal feelings. Maybe it was just a kind of a tribute to Ronaldo. But to be fair to him, he wasn't, like, giving it to the crowd or, like, doing it, like, right in front of them to rile them up. It seems like he just kind of turned towards his own teammates and did it. So, you know, maybe it was true what he said after the match, but even if he was doing it to wind up the Oppo fans, I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with it, and he didn't need to kind of justify himself at all.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on that front. But let's move on to your lot now, Max, because 2-0 down last season at home to Leicester under Roy, that game's done and dusted. Not so under Patrick, and although it was a share of the spoils, did it almost feel like a win in the end for your lot?
Yeah, you know what? When you come back from two goals down in the Premier League, it always feels like a win. I guess for Leicester, it probably would have felt like a loss, because Rodgers will have wanted them to hold out and get the 3 points once you're 2-0 up. But it was a good comeback. And as you say, against Roy last season, you know, we might have been, our mentality might have been, let's not let it get to 3-0, you know, let's just kind of hold out and not make it any worse. Whereas under Vieira, we do seem to have a real belief. And yeah, at Selhurst Park, I think that crowd made a really big difference in kind of sucking the ball in towards the net. Because if that were at the King Power away from home, I don't think we maybe would have had such momentum in the game. But it was a really good comeback. I was impressed with how we dealt with the kind of adversity, because obviously Leicester are a good team. I think I read somewhere they spent, like, the most time in the top four of any team in the last two seasons, which is absolutely mad considering they haven't qualified for the Champions League in either of those seasons. But, you know, they're a really good side. They've got a team full of internationals, full of European standard players. And, I mean, yeah, their defence looks a little bit weak at the moment. With the injuries that they've got to, like, Fofana and Evans, for example, and, you know, Pereira's kind of in and out a little bit. But, you know, they're a really good side. And I was also impressed by how his substitutes made a difference. You know, Edouard came on against Tottenham and sorry to remind you, by the way, and scored a couple. And then in this one, you know, Elise came on for Ayew. And basically, so far, Vieira's been making changes around kind of 70, 80 minutes, pretty late. But this time he took off Ayew in, like, the 58th, or, you know, around the hour, basically. And he gave Elise a good long time to affect the game. And he did. and then Schlupp comes on and scores within 45 seconds. And so I think that's really encouraging that not only are we looking better, you know, just kind of starting the game off generally, but also the changes that he's making are proactive and they are influencing the game, you know, meaningfully, which is really, really positive. So yeah, I was really pleased with the comeback. I think we probably deserve to win the game on the balance of play, and considering the manner of the goals that they scored, they were just kind of capitalising on our defensive mistakes, whereas, you know, their goals came against the run of play. We were really on top. We had a lot of possession. Again, we didn't necessarily convert all of that possession into really good, clear chances, but I think we probably should have won the game. Edouard hit the bar. Schlupp had a header at the end, very narrowly wide. And so a little bit frustrated that we didn't manage to win, but we're unbeaten at home. We are in a reasonable position in the Premier League. And given our fixture run that we've had at the start of the season, which has been very, very difficult, I'm really, really pleased with how we're doing and with where we are.
Yeah, I think in terms of the start, it's been solid, hasn't it? And I think you've got good reason to be confident to kick on. And I think it's going to be an exciting time at Selhurst Park. Are you worried at all, from a Leicester point of view, about Brendan Rodgers? Because as you noted there, lots of time in the top four, nothing really to show for it. It's not quite clicking this season. And if it doesn't quite click across the whole season, do you reckon the owners might go, thanks for everything, you've done great, but you've not quite delivered our remit, and off you go?
Oh, yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because he's been so good in managing Leicester in the last couple of seasons. The recruitment's been really, really good. You know, they look like a team with a lot of younger players, you know, with kind of room to improve as well. It's not like they're like Liverpool, where a lot of players are kind of 29, 30, and you think they might be coming to the end of their life cycle. They've got a lot of young players in that team. You know, Castagna, Fofana, Luke Thomas, Tielemans, Madison, Barnes, Daka, Iheanacho. You know, that's the core of a really good, strong side, Sumare as well, for the next 5 years. And so it's difficult because they have looked a little bit off colour this season.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the two successive campaigns where they've been in a prime position to get Champions League football, and they've dropped out at the last second, I wonder if that's taken a little bit of, you know, kind of, if that's taken a toll mentally, that's kind of sapped their energy, from a mental standpoint, because it must be really demoralising to feel like you deserve it and, you know, to play like a Champions League team for so much of the season and get some really good results against some really good teams, and then just to drop out twice in a row, and then this season they haven't quite been at it. But on the other hand, they've got a couple of injuries. Once their full strength team is back out and on the pitch, I think, you know, they could well qualify for the Europa League. I don't think they'll get Champions League this season. I think they probably missed their opportunity.
Okay, then we've got a few minutes left to go, so it's the quick fire round. The same time that Leicester was shipping points at Selhurst Park, Brentford was scooping all three at the London Stadium. Is it as close as a dream start for the Bees?
Yeah, I really don't think that Thomas Frank could have voted for a better start. They're seventh. They are seventh. They are 2 points behind Manchester City, 3 points behind Liverpool after 7 games of the season. So, you know, it's not like, you know, that they're like in the top four after 2 games where it's way too early in the season. I think we've definitely seen enough from them so far this season to kind of prove that they could maybe do another Leeds, and they can really, really test the top teams, because, you know, it's not one off. They've beaten Arsenal, they've beaten West Ham, they drew with Liverpool. They're a quality team, and we'll probably be talking about them a lot more across the rest of the season, because with those kind of performances, they could well finish in the top half.
Now, Chelsea, they stay top after, I guess, a routine win in the end over Southampton. The biggest talking point for me, though, was James Ward-Prowse getting a red card. Should he have been given one?
Yes, I don't think it was malicious, but I think it was a little bit reckless and out of control. He could have really injured Jorginho badly, so yes, it's a red for me.
Wolves got the better of Newcastle, and for all their attacking issues in the second half of last season, it does seem as Hwang Hee-chan could now be the perfect foil for Raul Jimenez.
Yeah, exactly, because they've got loads and loads of creative players in that team. You know, Neto, Pedence, Traore, Trincao. Jimenez is a fantastic creator, but they just don't seem to have someone who's kind of clinical enough to finish off those chances. In a previous life, Jimenez was that player, and he, to be fair, he scored a really, really nice goal the other week, but he doesn't seem to kind of just quite have that cutting edge back yet. It might happen for him, but Hwang, his finishes were, you know, they weren't easy goals by any stretch, but they were absolutely precise, calculated, you know, really nice low finishes, and he'll have a lot of confidence based on how he finished those chances. And yeah, Wolves' attack is now suddenly looking pretty tasty.
Leeds, they're off the mark in terms of league wins. They got the better of Watford. We mentioned Watford earlier, so that was the catalyst of that Cisco sacking. But the win, I guess, has been coming for Marcelo Bielsa this season. Does that ease any pressure that might have been forming on his shoulders?
I don't think there was much pressure on his shoulders. No. I think Bielsa is one of the most successful managers in the Premier League in terms of what he's done at Leeds. He's probably one of the most universally popular with the fans. He's probably the most backed by the board. They were desperate to give him a new contract this summer. So, I mean, this season, that, as you say, the results have been a little bit rubbish. Before that win against Watford, they'd drawn three and lost three. But their performances have probably warranted a little bit more, and they just haven't been clinical enough, and they've been giving away a couple of silly goals. But yeah, I don't think there's any pressure on Bielsa. Okay. He's going to be fine.
Talking of pressure then, Nuno Espirito Santo, he certainly had some on his shoulders after three big defeats in the league. He can breathe a bit easier after the win over Aston Villa. Still no goal for Harry Kane in the league though. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, Son was great, man of the match, and Dean Smith recognised that afterwards. But yeah, Kane's been a little bit off colour. I wonder if he's still troubled by that Manchester City move, particularly given the kind of the performances and the losses in the last three games. But you know, when Son is stepping up to the plate like that, Spurs can still win games even without Kane.
Brighton versus Arsenal, not a great deal to write home about. I guess a decent point for both sides. Arsenal keep their unbeaten run going to four matches. Brighton stay in the mix, in the title race, if we can call it that. But I guess a solid point for either team, and they'll take that. Burnley versus Norwich, also not really a lot to write home about. But Norwich are off the mark at least, Max. So it's a start for them. Can they build on that at least?
Yeah. It's a positive start. They probably needed to win that game, particularly against Burnley, who are very out of form, also winless. Also in the relegation zone, and they probably had the better of the chances as well. I mean, McNeil missed a great chance near the end. But yeah, I don't think Norwich are going to escape the relegation zone, but they will be glad to at least get off the mark.
Absolutely. Right, I think we've hit full time for the show. We won't mention Project 114 because it's over. It's done. The dream has died. So we're not going to Paris, unfortunately. I'll pick up with that on Matthew next week on next week's show. I know it's the international break next week, but I think we're going to talk about the 3 p.m. blackout. We mentioned that a few weeks ago. I think we're going to devote a whole episode to that. So we're going to keep the pod squad busy. Admin, of course, just need to thank Max for his sterling work this afternoon, wearing that captain's armband with pride. A pleasure to chat to you and a great effort once again.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm losing my voice a little bit. But yeah, really good to talk to you. And yeah, looking forward to next week.
Absolutely. Right, cheers, guys. And also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.